my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. A mind is a strange thing to have. For decades, the C word, consciousness, wasn't used by scientists in civilized settings. That is now changing. Charles Raison is a psychiatrist doing research in the efficacy of meditation, working closely with advanced practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism. Stuart Kaufman is a theoretical biologist, probing the relationships among mind, matter, and possibility. Dr. Stuart Kaufman, Dr. Charles Raison, if I were to have a patron saint, and I do not, I would say that our patron saint would perhaps be in common. I met you, Dr. Raison, when you were doing an elegant presentation of the Darwinian process in Western medicine. I met you, Dr. Kaufman, thinking about all kinds of issues that you articulated so beautifully in At Home in the Universe, all of which are deeply Darwinian. Uh-huh. That means that all three of us have a love of life in common, and the two of you, with the research you've done, you, Dr. Kaufman, as a theoretical biologist, and you, Dr. Raison, as a practicing psychiatrist and now also researcher, you start with a very fundamental premise that we could easily call Darwinian, couldn't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So does that give you something to talk about?
Oh, there's zillions of things.
Yeah.
The fact that you're both docs probably makes a difference in the way both of you think about most everything, doesn't it?
No, what do you think? For me, sure, of course, because that's a lot of what I do.
Yeah. You learn a lot of very general biology becoming a doctor. And I think it stands in very good stead. You know, I mean, I miss having been trained formally as a biologist, but not very much. I mean, anyway, biology is a funny field, you know, in the sense that it's enormously broad, but I hate to say this, it's not very deep.
Deep, yeah.
Right? I mean, you could get to the frontier of any area. Once you've learned the fundamentals of DNA, RNA, and proteins, and a little bit about population genetics and so on, I think you can get to the frontier of any area of biology in a couple 3 months of struggling.
Yeah, that's interesting. Why is that? I mean, that's
well,
so...
It's not like physics. We don't have this deep mathematical structure that you have to spend 15 years learning, right?
Yeah.
Because there isn't a deep theoretical biology, and I say that as a theoretical biologist.
Yeah. You came to Atlanta, Chuck, because you were interested in putting the mind and body together in a kind of silly way of saying it, but your interest in how the Eastern tradition could influence biology.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was interested. I'd had this interaction with the Dalai Lama's sister, and because of that, I met very, very intelligent Tibetan monk who I'd go out to dinner with once a week, and he told me all these stories about these guys, what they do at these monasteries, and I got really interested in some of these strange meditation procedures. These guys, sort of their central procedures to try to raise their body temperature by sort of breath for long periods of time. And this is actually what started me on all this. I got so obsessed with this idea of why would these guys for thousands of years do this? What's up with, why would you want to change your body temperature to affect your mood? Because basically these guys did this to try to generate these intense sort of implacable, unmovable bliss states, you know, and so that's actually how I started. Was I wanted to come out and figure out what were these guys doing from a Western perspective. I would, you know, mm-hmm. talk about reductionism. I wanted to try to figure out if I could see what were they, if they were doing it, how were they doing it. I thought it might mm-hmm. cast some light into, mm-hmm. you know, how people generate like intense mm-hmm. positive emotions. So yeah, so I did it. Never worked out. These guys wouldn't let themselves be studied, but
they wouldn't.
No, they had had some problems in the past being studied in the West. They'd all taken a death vow. Amazing, literally.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, they'd sworn that they would, and they were
die pretty, before they do it.
Mm-hmm. And they were pretty loyal to that. We got as far as meeting with the abbot of the monastery where they really do it. And, you know, it's funny. Tibetans don't tend to say no directly, but he told me the story about the head tummo practitioner. I said, you know, we were talking. Well, can we ever study this guy? I said, you know, head tummo practitioner was out in India recently, going around teaching, and he wanted to have some private time, so he went off and found a quiet spot beneath a tree and started doing tummo. And a goat wandered by and started watching him, and the goat went blind. They just changed subject. And I knew right then, nope, never going to happen. We're the goats, and we're never going to get to study this stuff. So.
But what had happened was the bad experience.
Oh, I don't know. I probably can't go into that on tape. But there had been attempts to study these guys in the West, and a great deal of misunderstanding between the Tibetan practitioners and the Western scientists. And the Tibetans felt like they'd been poorly handled and damaged by the experience, basically what happened. And it became this sort of lore in the Tibetan monastic world. And so, yeah.
A happier ending to that story is it did give a jumping-off point for studying a variety of things that interest you theoretically, that interest you in a practicing way, about the ways that minds and bodies affect each other and the Darwinian processes that undergird, if you will, all of life. Mm-hmm. I am Paula Gordon. It is my delight to be with Dr. Stuart Kaufman, Dr. Charles, whom I will call Chuck Rezan. We'll all be back in just a moment. Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon, Dr. Charles Rezan, Chuck, Dr. Stuart Kaufman. Stuart, have at it.
Okay. Well, Chuck, just before we started taping, you said something that it's not cheating to bring back up. We had a quick exchange in which we asked one another, somehow, do you believe that the mind's algorithmic?
Typical cocktail conversation.
Exactly.
Is the mind algorithmic?
Hey, that's a nice skirt. What do you think?
This is the way to, find a beautiful young woman.
Exactly.
They go crazy for that. I mean, there's a real come on. Okay?
Yeah. Oh, man.
And I'm saying that at 68. And it still works.
It's a beautiful thing.
She said, I don't know what to do with it. Chuck, so what you said was, you think the mind's algorithmic. In this book that I've just written, Reinventing the Sacred, the really new material is two chapters. One is on the mind, and the other is on the possibility, improbable scientifically, but possible, I will argue, that the consciousness might be quantum mechanical, which was first put forward by Roger Penrose, for which he caught a lot of flack, to put it politely. I rather firmly think the mind is not algorithmic. You immediately said that you thought it was before I voiced, I guess we got that far.
Yeah.
Then you said something that's fascinating to me that I'd like to hear you speak about, which is that this is one of the things that separates Buddhist theory, practice, from Western. I want to say, if I may, a couple more things and then ask you. We are captured in post-1950 Western neuroscience, said I as a doc like you, in a computational model, starting, for example, with McCulloch and Pitts, who I was lucky enough to live with Warren McCulloch, in which neurons are firing one another into on-off states. Then we get the computer, and then the computer can carry out all of these complex calculations. And then we get the computational theory of the mind, and it goes in two directions. One is sort of the syntactic linguistic modeling pathway, and the other is essentially connectionism, in which there are things like dynamical steady states and basins of attraction that flow to them, and those become categories and category generalizations and all of that. I think that's all great, but I don't think, in fact, that's an adequate theory of mind. And you do, I would guess. So, where does all this lie?
Where does it lie with?
Well, first of all, where does it lie with when the Tibetans say "uh-uh"?
Yeah.
What are they saying?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I guess their version of algorithmic processes would be something like karma, cause and effect, because that's sort of an algorithm, right? They have a sense that in that way, what happens to a consciousness stream is related in extremely complicated ways, but in predictable law-like ways to actions in the past. So I guess I should clarify that they do have a sort of sense of algorithm. But I think where it really splits apart is, you know, if the mind is an algorithm, then at the end of the day, it's an understandable phenomenon that arises from sort of, you know, these sort of, you know, maybe they're instantiated physically, but these sort of basic sort of, you know, yes, no kind of program things. Where they really split from the West, I think, is that they see that they have this belief that consciousness must arise from a previous moment of consciousness. And that, you know, it sounds like a simple thing, but a lot comes out of that, because essentially then they have this sense that there is, they don't like words like substance, but that there is something inviolate about consciousness, that if you get down to the most subtle layers of consciousness that are almost nothing, zippo, that what you find is it's consciousness all the way down. That it's not, so maybe I misspoke when you first said that, because they may see algorithmic patterns in consciousness. I mean, I think their idea of action and reaction in terms of karma is in some way algorithmic, but they don't see it in a sense of what I think you and I mean when we talk about an algorithmic idea of the mind, for instance, that could be modeled on a computer, right? Mm-hmm. I think that they wouldn't see it that way. They would see that at the end of the day, there's something inviolate, or mm-hmm. that at a certain point, consciousness, you don't get consciousness unless you got consciousness stream, consciousness stuff. Again, I bracket stuff, but that it's sure. not, they don't go for a full emergence, I suppose. And so, and
what do you mean? What did that last sentence mean?
A full emergence. That, you know, they would say that if you look at any compounded entity in mm-hmm. the world, you can take it apart. And you can take it apart again, and you can take it apart again, and you can take it apart. So that is sort of like they have a sort of emergent flavor that way. They don't believe that entities are, they wouldn't believe in a soul or something like that, that there's some sort of identity that's inviolate, that is partless, that, you know, that, I mean, they've got thousands of pages of stuff taking that apart, you know. But my sense of their kind of final stance is that if you look at, ask the question, what is a being, a sentient being? That it's this not particularly separable, but that there's this very, very subtle energy that's always linked to a consciousness element. Mm-hmm. And that consciousness element, that's what makes something sentient. It's more like it's like a subtle vitalism, maybe. You know, mm-hmm. you take that element out, and you now have lost sentience. Whereas mm-hmm. I think a standard brand scientific explanation would say that sentience emerges from the sort of interaction patterns of non-sentient elements. And they mm-hmm. would not go all the way to that. You know?
Where does it start? Is there a beginning of consciousness, or is it all for the them, universe has always been here?
For them, well, they believe in creation. I mean, they're very, the physics is right on line. Like this whole pocket universe idea and stuff would be right in line with them, this idea that there's multiple universes coming in and out of existence. They think most universes are empty most of the time. I mean, that's why they like this quantum mechanics stuff. But no, they think that consciousness is sort of eternal, essentially, you know, that you can't go back. Consciousness isn't created; it's not destroyed. So in that way, it's like I was reading the first part of your book. It's like the 24th, you know, element of the. They would add another element that is consciousness, basically. And mm-hmm. so, in that way, what I would mean by say an algorithmic idea that the mind is a sort of completely emergent thing that emerges like a. You know, that it is dependent, like, you know, Steven Weinberg thing, all the arrows point downward, but that it emerges from these smaller elements. They would say yes, in part, but there's always an infusion of something that's indissolvable. And mm-hmm. and that's their primary, that's my take and on like the primary difference. I mean, one of the reasons I think people are interested in Buddhism is I think that's a long way from a soul that's going to be plucked down, you know, taken away by God. It's much subtler. It's much more naturalistic. I mean, it's a naturalistic. They just believe that one of the sort of eternally naturalistic elements is consciousness. And
so, in that sense, they're dualists.
They're subtle dualists.
They're subtle dualists.
Mm-hmm.
They were a little before Descartes, but
yeah,
about 4,000 years.
Yeah. But I think they're subtle dualists, and you have a beer with some of these guys, and they'll split hairs with you. But that's what I think.
Bottom line is that they're kind of dualists.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and also I know just enough about this to know the notion of continuity of consciousness. Well, I think it rests on, you're the expert.
I'm not
expert than I am. There is the notion of mental causation.
Yeah.
Then I think there is the notion that everything that occurs has a sufficient antecedent
yes.
cause. Therefore, if there's mental causation, it whatever happened had to have an antecedent cause.
Mm-hmm. And the same character.
And therefore, it has to go all the way back forever.
Right.
And I think, well, I've been told that that's the root of the belief in reincarnation, mm-hmm. that consciousness can't begin and it can't stop.
Right.
Because you had to have a first cause.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yes. Exactly.
I remember going to a neural network conference, which would seem improbable to both of you who know me a little bit. And over and over and over again, there were these people from all over the world who were qualified to say, I'm going to use the C word. So as you talk about consciousness, this isn't just Tibetan Buddhism. This is a very active conversation within the Western scientific community, as well as with people who have been practitioners of a spiritual tradition for thousands of years. Consciousness is a very big, inviting subject, yes?
Yeah.
Well, and the
especially to a psychiatrist and a theoretical biologist.
Well, and I also did philosophy of mind,
yeah.
Chuck, when I was younger,
yeah.
at Dartmouth and at Oxford. When I was at Dartmouth and at Oxford, it wasn't polite to use the C word, okay? And in fact, it wasn't polite to use the C word, meaning consciousness, mm-hmm. 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Roger Penrose did is he brought it out of the closet. He might have gotten a lot of flack for it, but he did bring it out of the closet, and it's now okay to talk about consciousness. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was at Oxford, Gilbert Ryle had just written a book called The Ghost in the Machine.
Mm-hmm.
He was almost my tutor. He wasn't my tutor. But the basic argument was logical behaviorism. The behaviorists, you may recall, wanted to say, look, there's nothing going on in there, okay? It's just a correlation between inputs and outputs, okay?
Fortunately, Skinner is now dead.
Yeah.
He still has some followers, but he's dead.
Yeah. But essentially, they were trying to get rid of inner mental states, like experiences. And there was the logical equivalent of that, essentially logical behaviorism, and Ryle wrote a book that was a famous book called The Ghost in the Machine,
mm-hmm.
which basically says that conscious experiences aren't real. And an astonishing number of philosophers of my generation, and before my generation a little bit, and then maybe 20 years after, are busy arguing that experiences are an illusion, not real, whatever, which is, if I may be really simple in saying it, stupid. Because
yeah.
we're sitting here being conscious of what
we're having an experience. We're having that experience with Dr. Stuart Kaufman and with Dr. Charles Raison, both of whom will be here when we return, and we trust you will be too. Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon, Dr. Stuart Kaufman, a theoretical biologist and a great deal more, Dr. Charles Raison, who is both a psychiatrist and a practicing scientist and a great deal more. I'm Paula Gordon. I'm simply blessed with this opportunity. Dr. Kaufman?
How come you're always so graceful, Paula?
I'm doing this a lot.
Chuck, let me try to tell you why I think the mind is not algorithmic.
Please, I was going to add that.
Well,
there's
a method in my madness. Suppose that I'm right.
Okay.
Then there may be a... Then first of all, it's going to turn out we don't have a theory of mind.
Yes.
Okay. And second of all, there may be an interesting tie to Buddhism that we can really make. And it's a unique opportunity for me to have you here for us to be talking to one another. So
would that be testable?
I don't know.
Well, let's hear the theory first.
Not everything is testable, I'm afraid. Okay, but maybe it is. I don't know. So let's talk first of all about what an algorithm is.
Yeah.
So an algorithm is an effective formal procedure. By formal, I mean mathematical.
Delivers a predictable result.
Carried out, for example, by a Turing machine or mm-hmm. a computer, in which you put in some data in terms of some symbols, like ones and zeros.
Mm-hmm.
And then the machine cranks on them like a Turing machine does, and sometimes later it quits with an answer, or it goes on forever in the halting problem, and it doesn't halt for infinite time.
Right.
Okay, so that's what it is. Now, it'll take a few minutes to say this, Chuck, okay? There is, in cognitive science, something that's called the frame problem, okay? It is when you go into a restaurant You get into the restaurant going into frame, and then there are some things you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go to a chair. You're supposed to sit down. You're supposed to pick up a menu. Okay. And there's some sort of, and this is the crux move, there's some sort of finitely pre-statable list of actions or if-then statements. If such and such is on the menu, then order it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's some finite pre-statable set of if-then statements or whatever that constitute the frame. Now, out of that, then, if I can do that, then there's an effective procedure in which I can grind through it all and do whatever I'm supposed to do.
Would that be an algorithm?
That would be an algorithm. Yeah. Right. The way I'm going to try to battle that idea is to say that, in general, you can't get that finite set of statements. You can't get started. Okay? And it'll take me a couple of minutes to say it.
Yeah.
And it will partially repeat what we've talked about before. So I have to tell you quickly what a Darwinian adaptation, then pre-adaptation is, and then the puzzle will arise. So to say it fast, if you were to ask Darwin, what's the function of the heart? He'd say, pump blood. And then you'd say, but look, the heart makes heart sounds. And he'd say, but that's not the function of the heart. The heart was selected to pump blood. So that's what we both know.
Yeah,
that.
Right.
Okay. Now, you may or may not know the idea of a Darwinian pre-adaptation.
I do.
You do. Okay,
yeah.
So just to say it again so that we're for sure on the same page. His idea was that a property of part of you that is not useful in the current environment might turn out to be useful in some other environment. And the one case will suffice, given the shortness of time. The inner ear bone, the middle ear bones in you, the incus, stapus, and malleus and stapus, derive from the evolution of three adjacent bones in the jaw of some fish 400 or 500 million years ago.
Right. Which is one of our very, very early progenitors.
Yes,
yeah.
which is one of our... So this is clearly Darwinian pre-adaptation, in which the first two claims that I'll make are easy. Did a new function come to exist in the biosphere? Yep, hearing. Did it affect the biosphere? Yep, new species, new proteins, all sorts of stuff. The critical question is the following. Do you think you could say ahead of time, all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations, say for all species alive now, or just for humans?
Mm-mm. I don't think so.
Everybody thinks the same thing, Chuck. So, there's a lot of consequences of what you just said. I'm going to tell you two reasons why I think you can't do it. Okay? Then I'm going to tell you that I don't know how to prove it. Then I'm going to go flying off for a minute.
And then Chuck can talk.
This is a crux thing,
and it's worth struggling with.
Yeah.
I think a lot's at stake here, like several thousand years of Tibetan Buddhism, and it's tied to the West. So one reason I think you can't do it is I don't think you can list all possible selective environments. I mean, how would you get started on the task of listing all possible selective environments?
Yeah, but I think it's probably impossible. There might be essentially infinite selective environments across space and time.
Yeah. Now,
Darwin tells us that environment is deeply important.
Sure, it's what.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Now, the next part of it is that relational properties matter in coevolution.
Yes.
Or in Darwinian pre-adaptations.
And in coevolution, too.
In this case, it's the fact that the three jaw bones are adjacent to one another, and they wind up adjacent to one another in our middle ear. So the spatial arrangements matters to their emergence in the Darwinian...
What they can be.
One had been in the spine, one had been in a fin, and one had been in the jaw...
That's not how we would hear.
It probably wouldn't have evolved, right?
Right.
So that puts us in the following position, sort of with Leibniz, that we would have to list all relational properties of sort of everything to everything, and there's no way of doing that.
Okay.
How would we do it? Okay?
Yeah.
All right? Now, so one little more toy example that we talked about, Paula, Bill, and I before. Suppose I gave you a screwdriver and a hammer, a screwdriver and a nail and a piece of cloth. Can you tell me all the things that you could do with it?
I'll give you a hint. Yeah. The short answer is no.
No, probably not. Right. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Right? No.
Yeah.
And it might depend upon how far all of those things are from Fresno or, yes. or from
sure.
the wall.
Of
right?
course. Yeah.
So somehow we can't list everything.
Right.
Okay? Now, I think that this is related to the frame problem. So let's just take it with screw and screwdriver. So, let me stick with Darwinian preadaptations. I think this means a whole bunch of things. The first thing I think it means is the following, Chuck. The bias here is evolving into what I will call the adjacent possible, sort of the next thing that can mm-hmm. happen.
But which comes out of chemistry, that whole concept.
Which comes out of chemistry and the kinds of molecules you can make next given what you got now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's definable. I don't think we can say what the adjacent possible is. That's what you just said we can't do. You just
right.
said no, okay?
Right. Yet
it happens. Okay, Darwinian preadaptations
yeah.
are happening. I think the same thing may be happening in the mind, okay? In which, so I'll give you an example.
Okay.
I will, because then I can get directly to the frame problem. I'm sorry if this is repeating a story, Paula. So some guys are trying to invent a tractor.
Yeah.
They have this huge engine block. They put it on a chassis, breaks the chassis. They keep making bigger and bigger and bigger chassis, keeps breaking them all. Finally, one of the engineers says, you know what, you could use the rigidity of the engine block and mount everything on the engine block itself and use it as the chassis.
Yeah.
That's a Darwinian preadaptation, right?
It's mm-hmm. also a tractor.
Yeah.
And it's a tractor.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot to say tractor. Did I forget to say tractor?
Yeah. It is a tractor.
That is how tractors are made.
Yeah.
So making a tractor made use of an unused causal property of the engine block, its rigidity, for a new function.
Yeah.
Okay? Okay. That's precisely the frame problem. The rigidity of the engine block isn't in a pre-statable, it could be, but I mean it's not in the normal statable frame about the properties of an engine block, and therefore there's no deductive or algorithmic way to get to what the engineer did. That, in other words, unless we can, I didn't say that very well. Suppose you had a list of the properties of the engine block, but it didn't include the rigidity of the engine block.
Then you wouldn't know.
There would be no way to get to it, right? There would be no way to get to...
But yet in this example, somebody got to it.
Somebody
right.
did get
exactly.
to it.
Exactly.
Right.
So the problem becomes, and then I'll shut up and it's your turn. The problem becomes that there seems no way to state all the properties of things in themselves and relational properties of things that might turn out, for example, to be useful for something. Yet we do it all the time. So I conclude from this that we do things that cannot be done algorithmically because we cannot pre-state the set of possibilities. And to restate it, that's the frame problem. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, this is why I think the mind is... This is one of the reasons I think the mind is not algorithmic.
So suppose eventually people developed a computer program that through any stated fact... let's say some evolutionary thing where they just let things run and it developed the ability to behave in the real world more like a being with, more like a living being. Would you then say that the computer was no longer algorithmic or that that's inherently impossible because it's not? Or would you say that you've now developed a machine that's complex enough that it's tapping into quantum effects? Because this is a sort of interesting question it's true. We don't, I think this is, why artificial intelligence has been so difficult, isn't it? Is that, that you have to finding a frame is very difficult. And yet I look at what's been done in the last 15, 20 years and I see, kind of rather remarkable process in terms of
machines. Yeah, there's language pattern recognition.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Clearly, if that were to continue, created things would be able to behave like volitional beings that could make interesting decisions, not being able to answer or understand all the frames in which they're in. So how does that work?
Well, so one of the questions is can there be such machines?
That's right.
And my suspicion is that just maybe there can't be. Okay. I mean, obviously we've gotten really complicated computing machines. We just alluded to it and agreed to it. And besides when we call the telephone, company, we're experiencing one of them.
Okay? Yes.
So there's two directions one could go now. One is just asking whether or not the mind's algorithmic, and the second would be, and you mentioned it's quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Quantum mechanics, the possibility that mind is quantum mechanical, isn't impossible. I've really now looked into it pretty thoroughly. Scientifically, it's pretty improbable.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just spend a moment on it. Okay.
Sort of my sentiment.
It turns out that chlorophyll, which is, you know, captures sunlight for photosynthesis, yeah, is quantum coherent for about a nanosecond.
Oh.
And it's got a protein wrapped around it. Do you know about decoherence?
No, actually.
Okay. Do it for me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the big puzzle in quantum mechanics is how you get from quantum possibilities captured in the Schrodinger wave and the Copenhagen interpretation to anything real ever happening. Because mm-hmm. in quantum mechanics, nothing real ever happens on the Copenhagen interpretation. There are other interpretations. And the way it happens on the Copenhagen interpretation is the collapse of the wave function, mm-hmm. you know, when you measure something classically. The modern version of the collapse of the wave function is called decoherence, and the idea is that the phase information in the quantum waves essentially gets lost. It gets sort of lost out into the universe, and once it's lost, you can't get quantum interference again, so things become classical.
Yeah.
Okay. Crudely.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, having said that, there's now pretty good evidence that the chlorophyll molecule at body temperature, at room temperature, is quantum coherent, not for very long, but a nanoseconds long, if you're thinking on the Planck time scale of 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. And there's a protein around it called the antenna protein that is almost certainly suppressing decoherence, which means natural selection cared to preserve coherence, because somehow it's good for energy transport from the photon that comes in to activating the reaction center that then drives photosynthesis.
Yeah.
Okay, so that plus some theorems in quantum computing suggests that it's not impossible that something quantum mechanical could be going on. It's a long scientific step.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it should be taken with a pound of salt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not impossible. That's interesting because on the Copenhagen interpretation, you beat the problem of causal closure. Because in quantum mechanics, the quantum wave thing, you know, the possibilities in the Schrodinger equation, are entirely acausal. Okay? They're just possibilities.
Right.
So there is no first cause because there's no cause at all.
Yeah.
Okay? So the whole problem of first cause that we were alluding to before simply disappears. Whether or not it helps with algorithmicity or not is an open question, because you can make quantum computers that are perfectly algorithmic.
Absolutely. That's right.
The flip side of it is you can have classical things like planets, and it's not obvious that they're computing an algorithm at all. They're going around
that's right.
the sun. They're doing their thing.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not sure that cuts either way.
Yeah.
So just to come back to the starting spot, Chuck, I think our mind is doing things that cannot, just like the biosphere is evolving in ways that cannot be pre-stated, but it's doing it anyway, without any consciousness, okay, 2 billion years ago, say, when presumably nothing was conscious, I think maybe the mind is doing things, going into an adjacent possible, seizing opportunities like using the rigidity of the engine block for a purpose that cannot be calculated.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that there's no effective procedure to get to it because you couldn't state ahead of time all the relational properties. So I think we've got to embrace the possibility that the mind can be algorithmic. Obviously it can. We can do long division.
Yeah.
But maybe it's much deeper than that, and maybe the mind is non-algorithmic. And that would tie a whole new blasting weird thing that may be correct that is maybe going to hit Western science, because among other things, I'm trying to say it, to When was Buddha? 2500 BC?
No, about 500 BC.
500. Well, okay, so that gives us 2500 years of history.
Yeah.
That would tie us to a Tibetan tradition that right now, the computational model of the mind, which is very seductive, says, uh-uh, you Tibetans are wrong. Maybe they're not.
And with innovation possible in all kinds of parts of the universe, we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Stuart Coffman, Dr. Charles Raison. And before we leave, Chuck, you want to say?
No, we'll pick it up.
We'll pick it up when we come right back. Be with us. Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon, Dr. Stuart Coffman, theoretical biologist and much more, Dr. Charles Raison, my friend Chuck, and much more. Your turn.
So here's my question for you. So is the...
If, coming out of the West Corner.
Yeah, that's right. I sense an implication in what I've read of your work and also what you're saying right now, that there may be something liberating or hopeful about the fact that the mind is not algorithmic, and that essentially, if I understood what you were saying now, that basically it may be a type of phenomena that is, in principle, unknowable, that you can't write an equation for it, that it transcends that. So my first question, I got two questions. So one, is this just saying that the mind is a class of entity that is sort of epistemologically unknowable, that there's something either because of the limitations of our consciousness or something in the warp and woof of space-time, that it's a type of complex phenomena that cannot be completely brought into a sort of scientific... Because scientific, we always think kind of algorithmic. That's sort of the essence of scientific...
Or mathematizable,
yeah,
which algorithmic is examples.
Exactly. That's number one. Are you suggesting that in its essential nature... it is just unknowable, or are you making a stronger ontological claim that behind that unknowability is some sort of other type of process, other type of being or element? And if so, what would that be? That's my question. And the second is, if essentially, let's say consciousness is an essentially unknowable, like these other complex systems, that their primary sort of essence is that they are like quantum events in a way, deeply unpredictable. That they may, you know, the space that they move into, you can never find the right frame for the space they're going to move into. That, you know, you can kind of predict, you kind of hit it and miss it, but sometimes they do stuff that's just like, wow, nobody would have ever thought of that. How is that a cause for hope as opposed to despair?
Boy.
In 35 words or fewer.
Yeah, that's what I said. But I mean, this is... I stayed awake last night thinking about this. I thought, you know, what is...
Let's hit this guy with why is it hope?
Yeah, that is the real...
Well,
you
and,
know.
And we spent a great deal of time talking earlier in the day about open systems.
Yeah.
And it's a direct fit to that part of the conversation of orthodoxy versus openness.
Yeah.
Chuck, you've hit on all the right questions, to which, of course, I don't have the answers. But let me start... let me start at one spot.
Okay.
I'm going to say several things, and they're all utterly puzzling.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're now. If what you agreed to, that we couldn't say ahead of time or finitely prestate all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations for humans is right.
Yes, which clearly it must be. Yeah.
Well, we all agree. Everybody agrees. Let's just pause over that because everything hinges on that assent. And everybody agrees to it. Let's just look at that for a moment. We're both doctors and scientists.
Right.
How would you prove it? And it's not clear how you'd prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No.
Would you do an experiment? Would you prove a theorem?
Mm. Somehow
we think not for some other reason. Let's just accept it as yes right now and leave it as a puzzle to come back to and have a good scotch over. Now we come to another question. So let's talk about this adjacent possible. Now let me talk about things that aren't quite adjacent possible. Okay? That is to say, there seems to be some things that are really close mm-hmm. in what's possible and some things that are further away. And my favorite example is a channel changer, okay, TV channel changer, which needs a couch potato, some television stations, some programming, and some television sets. And then you can invent it and make a buck.
Yeah.
You couldn't in the year 1200 in Europe. Right?
Right.
So it was further away.
Right.
Now let's ask the first question that you asked, which is, can we mathematize the adjacent possible? Okay?
Yeah.
Now, we have been taught in the West since Pythagoras and since the Greeks discovered that music was the chord structure of vibrations, right?
Right.
We have been led to believe that everything in the universe is mathematizable.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We really have.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And that's the root of reductionism in physics, and Galileo and Newton and Weinberg and the dreams of a final theory and string theory and all that stuff.
Who've done a bang-up job with that notion that you can mathematize everything.
You can mathematize everything. I don't know the answer, of course, Chuck. But I'll tell you two things. The coming into existence of middle ear bones, and I'd also tell a story about swim bladders,
yeah,
means that the state space of the biosphere cannot be pre-stated. All of our mathematics, because nobody knew that middle ear bones were going to come up.
Right.
So we can't do what Newton told us to do, have the variables and the laws and the whatever, and then calculate. Okay?
Right.
That means we can't state the state space of the biosphere. Now, in fact, we can't even make probability statements about them, because to do that, you have to know what the sample space is, and we don't.
Right.
So we don't have any mathematics for that which is going to come into existence, but we don't know it. There's no mathematical structure. It's not obvious to me that we can mathematize this adjacent possible. It's also not obvious to me that it's not. Nothing's obvious to me.
You'd say even probabilistically you couldn't? Because, I mean, one possibility is that, you know, that in very, very complex systems, that you can probabilistically, you know, do a better shot of things that are very, very adjacent than further away.
Well, indeed, we can.
Yeah.
Somehow we can.
Yeah.
That feels right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like weather forecasting, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They're going to screw up, but they're going to be better for 5 o'clock this afternoon than 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Yes, you're right, but let me draw a distinction. Weather forecasting is talking about a chaotic dynamical system, and you know about deterministic chaos.
Yep.
So I got some box,
yeah,
and I've got some trajectory in the box, and once I get onto the attractor in the box, nearby states diverge.
Yeah.
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 We're both familiar,
yeah,
with it. But I know the box. Okay?
We roughly know the box, right?
Yeah, you roughly know the box.
And that's an epistemological problem. You would say that could we completely know that box if we knew everything about every quantum state of every air particle? If you had the computing power to do that, maybe.
Well, I we'll go off in that direction,
okay,
in a second. It's called the Church of the Ever Larger Hilbert Space.
A
phrase that I learned about a month ago, and I'm in love with it.
Yeah,
okay, so let's get there in a sec. Okay. So, but there is a view of quantum mechanics in which, and I think you'll agree that it's nuts when I tell you what it is, but maybe it's not. I don't know. Anyway, it seems to me that we can't mathematize this adjacent possible. And So let's try probability statements for a second. Suppose you flip a coin 10,000 times.
Yeah.
Fair coin.
Yeah.
5,000 heads, 5,000 tails, plus some,
yeah,
distribution. It's a Poisson distribution. But you knew ahead of time all the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
You don't,
right,
for the emergence of Darwinian pre-adaptations. You don't know the possibilities. That's what you agreed to.
Yeah, but this is where I came back to the question, is that an epistemological limitation or something built in to the nature of the universe itself, right? Because it's, again, this is the, you know, the ever-larger space of what you'd have to know. But that, to me, is a key question, right? Is it,
yeah,
just that it's essentially incalculable and what would require...
Is this okay?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, maybe what would be required to do it is intractable, that it's essentially impossible because it just, there's not enough space and time in all of eternity to do it.
Right.
That's one possibility. That seems to me to be different than the idea.
But in principle, it's not.
Mm-hmm. And if it's not possible in principle, then what is it?
They're all fundamental questions. It seems at least that no computer in the universe could do it. So it's at least intractable.
Right.
Okay, we have no problem with that. It may be in principle impossible. I don't know. We're at the edge of what we know about.
Yeah.
Nobody knows about this. Okay. So let's hold the Church of the Ever Larger Hilbert space off on the side and come back to it in a minute, because it's either profound or amusing,
yeah,
or both. Okay. The second thing you raised was, so what's this consciousness anyway? You must know David Chalmers and the statement of the hard problem.
I know David Chalmers, but why don't you?
He got to be famous by saying that the hard problem is experience itself.
Mm.
Now, he did more than that, but I mean, that's essentially what he's
saying. That's enough for today.
Which is sort of neat, but I'm not, it was always pretty clear to me that that was the hard problem. So, I got to tell you that even if you say mind is quantum mechanical, it doesn't explain why we have experiences.
No, I agree. And I think your point about the fact that you can build a quantum computer doesn't get you out of the algorithmic question either. Right?
Absolutely, it doesn't.
Right, right.
It doesn't. The quantum possibility does answer questions about mental causation, and it, in principle.
Yeah.
And it does answer questions about possibly free will. Possibly.
Maybe.
It's not clear that it...
Although I struggle with that a little bit.
I do too.
I don't see how that sort of randomness...
That's right. The problem is that how do you get a responsible free will?
Exactly.
Yeah. We've thought about the same things, Chuck.
Okay. Yeah.
So, so I don't think anybody has the faintest clue any more than you do about what consciousness, quotes, is. Nobody knows. It's as Jerry Fodor says, not only do we not know, we don't know what it would be like to know.
Yeah.
Right? But now I'm going to tell you something that's really weird. And I don't know what to make of it. See what you think of it.
Okay.
Okay? So you agree with me that the channel changers in the adjacent possible of the economy of, say, 1980.
Yeah.
And somebody invented it and made a buck.
Yeah.
And it wasn't in the adjacent possible of 1200 AD
right.
Europe.
Absolutely.
Or even 1900 AD America.
No. Closer, but not there.
Closer, but not
Very there. Unlikely that in one step.
You could get
And
there.
If it did, there wouldn't be an environment for it to be right, adaptive in.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, here's the weird step. I only use the word feel, because I'm scared to use the word is.
Yeah.
Doesn't it feel like what's in the adjacent possible, or an adjacent possibility, if we don't want to... no matter what you do, it seems to be a noun. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay? Is a necessary condition for what comes to exist?
Say that again.
Okay. In 1980, there is an adjacent... I want to say... Let me just say it.
Say what you want to say.
It's like there is this adjacent possible, and it's like the economy evolves into it, and channel changes do come into existence, and... If it wasn't in the adjacent possible, using a noun form that may be seductive, then it couldn't come into existence.
Do you know his name, Julian Barbour, the guy who wrote The End of Time?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds a little bit like that's a way of thinking about, right, that maybe this sort of, I mean, this is very deterministic, right? Another way to say it is at some deep level, it's all there, and that the adjacent possible is... You know, we may not be able to epistemologically take a guess at it, but that somehow
it's already there,
mm-hmm, and it is pulling things toward it.
Oh well, neat! It's pulling things towards it. Actually, I haven't read Julian Barbour, but I know that he's dealing with the problem.
But that's
time.
Right. This idea that basically, you know, that there is no time, and that moments have this bizarre characteristic of.
Of becoming.
Of, yes, and also that they have they're coded with this sort of pastness or futureness in relationship to each other, but it's a really strange, interesting idea, but I thought of that when you're talking about this, because it sounds like, you know, this idea that there's something, it's unknowable, but it's just like the future is, it's pulling everything toward itself, right? I can't think of the right word for it, but that it's... Anyway, okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I got to read Julian Barbour. I've actually talked to him a couple of times, but I've never read it. But let's try it.
Okay.
On all these, notice how wild all this is. So let's just leave it adjacent possible. Then you can tell me about Julian Barbour. Suppose that we actually let ourselves say, without being drunk, that what's in the adjacent possible of the economy. Is a necessary condition for the coming into existence of something in the real universe, like channel changers,
mm-hmm.
or like the bones of your middle ear. Okay.
Yeah.
This is really weird.
It's there a type of reverse causality, almost, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what it is, but look, there's two places where that possible seems to matter. One's in quantum mechanics, where you have the Schrodinger wave, which is on the Copenhagen interpretation, right, a possibility wave,
yeah,
okay, which when you square the heights becomes a probability that if you use a classical measuring apparatus, you will measure certain pre-stated quantum possibilities, and here's the probability of them, like yeah, the polarization of this photon.
Yeah.
And here's this other funny possible, which is about television channel changers being able to come into existence. Look at, I mean, all of this modal talk, okay? I've got this strange feeling, Chuck, and I don't know what to make of it, that we've got to, maybe we've got to take the ontological notion of the possible seriously. Maybe it's complete balderdash. I really don't know. But there's something about this that doesn't feel completely nuts. Do you agree?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, in addition to what's going on, where does hope fit into this? Because you, if you start talking about these big things and the improbable and the possible,
well, that's right.
Your original question was, and how is it hopeful?
Uh-huh. Yeah, if it's unknowable, how is it hopeful? And if you can't tell what the probable is, if the probable is extremely distressing. And I mean, that's because one of the implications of this would be that there's a, which is very Buddhist, it would seem to me there's an extremely finite thing you can do to improve circumstances in the physical world, right? I mean, basically, this is clearly an implication
of this.
Well,
the Buddhists say there's always going to be suffering. You can...
Absolutely. I mean, in this realm, that's right. Although their system's very different. There's some ways in which it's a very different idea because they also, you know, believe in these sort of realms where evolutionary processes have stopped and suffering has stopped, which is very big. That's another big difference. They have an end to evolutionary processes. And they also believe in omniscience. Not omnipotence, but omniscience, which would also be completely in violation of this idea, right? So mm-hmm. there's some profound, profound differences. As I think about this, that's if I mean, so we're talking about something different. It may be that this is like T.S. Eliot, Four Quartets, too. You know, you hear the footfalls in the world you didn't come into, this idea that there's something, you know, and this makes me want to ask you about many, many universe theories, because that's the other question about what happens to the possible that doesn't seem to happen, you know.
Well, it's often some other universe.
Well, are we done with hope?
Well, no, because I still want to know.
Hope
if there's
is a big one for
I mean,
me.
If you can't know.
You remember Pandora's box.
Yeah, well, this is the question, is that, you know, the algorithmic models of the mind seem hopeless to people because it seems as if the mind then is a sort of thing that can be
it's
built.
It's a machine.
It's a machine, and that bugs people. Non-algorithmic notions of the mind seem hopeful because they can't be put into that box. But what I hear you articulating is that part of that is that there's this sort of, that they are densely intractable to this sort of algorithmic, scientific, mathematizing kind of things. So then the question is, you know, you talk about, well, what kind of process would it be? And the other question is, why is that a ground for hope? Because if it puts absolute limits then on what could be done to affect those processes or to know those processes. And so, you know... Whereas, you know, some people make arguments that algorithmic models are hopeful because they allow for various, you know, like, I don't know if you read David Deutsch or some of these guys that, you know, the ideas that if the Turing principle is universally true, that it might be possible to sort of algorithmically rebuild things that one finds very meaningful, like oneself in a future world, right? That, you know, I mean, this is the...
Could it be your brother, so who cares?
Yeah, that's right. Have you ever read The Physics of Immortality?
No.
That's another...
I'm going to come back to hope when we return in just a moment with Dr. Charles, known to be as Chuck Raison, Dr. Stuart Coffin. We'll all be back in a moment. Welcome back. It is my great pleasure to be with Dr. Charles Raison, my friend Chuck, with Dr. Stuart Coffin, my friend Stuart. This business about that little voice in there when Pandora... this is a very ancient notion. That's about as old and Greek as one gets in terms of that mythology. This question of hope is right at the heart of how do you get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. You are very experienced with depression and
right.
things.
Yep.
This is deeply human, maybe life form, but certainly within the human experience. Yeah. Science isn't just you guys talking these big words. Science is also about life, and life includes how do you get up in the morning, and that gets me yes. back to your question about hope,
yep.
which either is or is not algorithmic. But talk a little bit, wait, you know, 4 or 5 minutes.
Well, I would love to. I mean, if we could end with this, because I think this is the key. This, to me, is the key question, is that, you know, there's something about unknowability that feels sacred.
Unknowability?
Yeah, unknowability.
That feels sacred.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
the mystery.
That's in essence, right,
this
exactly.
This is mysterious.
Uh-huh.
This is the mystic.
But mysteries, oh, you know, mysteries are double-edged swords, right? They can be extremely bad. They can be causes of great non-hope, if by hope one means sort of wanting to see a fulfillment of goals and things that are important to the self. And so there's a very dark side to an algorithmic world, which is, as you've, you know, in your book very eloquently said, you know, you get facts, you don't get values. You know, there's this emptying out of the sense that there's something adheres to reality that's mysterious and beautiful, and it speaks to something. You know, where really at the end of the day, I think it speaks to this sort of sense that, you know, things are good and getting better. You know, that there's something positive you can hope for. And so, as I was thinking about your work and what the sort of points you articulate, the question is, if essentially consciousness is non-algorithmic and hence, by definition, unknowable, and if in fact the future is non-algorithmic and hence unknowable, why would we bias hope as opposed to despair from that proposition?
Chuck, that's just a wonderful question. So let me tell you a little story. Not that I have an answer. When I first came across this stuff about the fact that we can't pre-state Darwinian pre-adaptations, and in our daily lives also, in the evolution of the biosphere and the economy, I thought to myself, what am I going to do? And I felt bereft. This all took about a minute and a half. And I thought, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Then I thought, and this was the hopeful part. It actually is hopeful. I thought to myself, wait a minute, we've been doing it for 3.8 billion years. Somehow, we know how anyway. Okay, now I don't know what that means, but
yes.
Somehow we know how
right.
Anyway. And then I thought to myself, I don't deduce my life, I live it. Okay? And then I say, rather hopefully to myself, we live our life with faith and courage, which in the Kantian sense is somehow sublime in the face of not knowing or that sacredness that you talk about, or in this sense, mystery, because somehow it's the mandate of life. Does it prove yet that we're going to make it better? Not that I can see.
Yeah.
But maybe it does. Maybe it gives us the possibility of making it better. Okay? That these are our choices.
And you have both set me up so wonderfully, because for the last 10 or 12 years since first coming upon your work, when people will ask me something of that order, I'll say, well, let me tell you what I learned many years ago from theoretical biologist Stuart Kaufman. All you can do is do your best, because you can never know the outcome.
Of course, that isn't grounds for hope.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
But it's grounds for getting up in the morning.
It is grounds for getting up in the morning. It is grounds for getting. I think, you know, there's something so deep in what you're saying. I believe, Chuck, that, and this is why I'm glad that you're in touch with the Tibetan Buddhists, I think we need to find some sense of the sacred across all of our secular and religious traditions. Mm-hmm. As a global civilization is of some form,
yeah.
Either heterogeneous or homogeneous, is emerging before our fundamentalisms that we're retreating into kill us.
Yeah.
Now, a transcendent, omniscient, loving God certainly offers hope. I mean, that God loves you, and
right.
You're going to go to heaven, and it's going to be great. If God is, as I want to say, the creativity in the universe, which is partially lawless for the reasons mm-hmm. that we're just saying, because a law is a compact description of the regularities of a process, and we can't have it for these things. So
yeah.
we're faced with partial lawlessness. Then we got to find, if we could find, let me back up, if we could find a pathway to hope, that would help. I have one little piece, okay?
Yeah.
This sense of God is not a God who can love me back, because it's not an agent.
Yeah.
It is the creativity of nature. But Chuck, I can love this sense of God. I can have a sense of reverential membership in the entire unfolding of the biosphere that I and we partially co-create. And I actually, in the last year and a half, have been experiencing it. Now, love, Jesus told us, love thy neighbor. Well, how about love thy creative universe, including all the trees and the worms and the bushes, the bunnies, mm-hmm. and love it. Go out in the woods and experience it. And what I find is, I've said it, this new sense of membership, stewardship, knowing that we're stupid, awe, in something vastly bigger than me, in this co-creating biosphere, that's hope, because love itself is hope. You're the psychiatrist, but love itself carries hope.
Generative?
It's a generative hope.
So your argument, do we have time for this?
Until it runs out.
Okay. So you would say that algorithmic processes cannot engender that sense of mystery or sacredness. There's something built into the human mind that to have this sort of it's an affective experience and it's also an intellectual experience. It must be about things that cannot be completely described with mathematics, which basically means that they're not fully lawful, and that things that fall under those domain become vitiated of that whatever it is, that unknowableness. And that unknowableness in itself does not mean that unknowableness, it could be God, it could be the devil. And really, I mean, if you don't know, you don't know, right?
You don't know.
But that there's something about that state that then at least opens the door for you to have an emotional experience, that there's something, you can choose to have hope, I suppose, right?
Yeah. There's sort of two different stances towards, I think, what you just said. Let's look at Spinoza. And Spinoza says, roughly speaking, God is reality. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's very similar.
No, it is very similar. Yeah. What I've come across is this idea that we really can't say that part of what happens, at least in the biosphere and up, is beyond natural law. So I find myself invited to think, let's identify the sense of God with the creativity in this partially beyond natural law creativity in the universe, which therefore is non-algorithmic, but now, or non-lawful. But was Spinoza wrong? I mean, what about the part that does seem to be law-governed, like the way stars work and so
on? Absolutely.
Is there any reason we shouldn't find awe and respect and reverence for that? Well, there's no good reason that I can think of. I'm awed by that, and I'm even more awed by the staggering complexity of what's come about in the biosphere and human evolution and human culture and all of that. But I could get talked into Spinoza plus this lawlessness as well. That which is law-governed, describable, we can't change. It's deterministic if it's Newton, and if it's quantum, well, they're throws of the quantum dice. If it's us acting, we're co-creators of it.
And this is a conversation which we have co-created and will continue another day. Gentlemen, this has been fun. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, yeah.
We thank both Drs. Raison and Kaufman for their imaginations, inquisitiveness, and commitment to discovery. We're continuing to talk with both researchers. The answers aren't in, but the questions are getting better. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.